Marriage and Parentage. In 1843, I was united to my first husband, Colonel George Washington Glover of Charleston, South Carolina, the ceremony taking place under the paternal roof in Tilton. After parting with a dear home circle, I went with him to the South, but he was spared to me for only one brief year. He was in Wilmington, North Carolina, on business when the yellow fever raged in that city and was suddenly attacked by this insidious disease, which in his case proved fatal. My husband was a Freemason, being a member in St. Andrew's Lodge No. 10 and of Union Chapter No. 3 of Royal Arch Masons. He was highly esteemed and sincerely lamented by a large circle of friends and acquaintances whose kindness and sympathy helped to support me in this terrible bereavement. A month later, I returned to New Hampshire, where, at the end of 4 months, my babe was born. Colonel Glover's tender devotion to his young bride was remarked by all observers. With his parting breath, he gave pathetic directions to his brother Masons about accompanying her on her sad journey to the North. Here it is but justice to record they performed their obligations most faithfully. After returning to the paternal roof, I lost all my husband's property, except what money I had brought with me, and remained with my parents until after my mother's decease. A few months before my father's second marriage to Mrs. Elizabeth Patterson Duncan, sister of Lieutenant Governor George W. Patterson of New York, my little son, about 4 years of age, was sent away from me and put under the care of our family nurse who had married and resided in the northern part of New Hampshire. I had no training for self-support, and my home I regarded as very precious. The night before my child was taken from me, I knelt by his side throughout the dark hours, hoping for a vision of relief from this trial. The following lines are taken from my poem, Mother's Darling, written after this separation. Thy smile through tears as sunshine o'er the sea awoke new beauty in the surge's roll. O, life is dead, bereft of all with thee, star of my earthly hope, babe of my soul. My second marriage was very unfortunate, and from it I was compelled to ask for a bill of divorce, which was granted me in the city of Salem, Massachusetts. My dominant thought in marrying again was to get back my child, but after our marriage his stepfather was not willing he should have a home with me. A plot was consummated for keeping us apart. The family to whose care he was committed very soon removed to what was then regarded as the Far West. After his removal, a letter was read to my little son, informing him that his mother was dead and buried. Without my knowledge, a guardian was appointed him, and I was then informed that my son was lost. Every means within my power was employed to find him, but without success. We never met again until he had reached the age of 34, had a wife and 2 children, and by a strange providence had learned that his mother still lived and came to see me in Massachusetts. Meanwhile, he had served as a volunteer throughout the war for the Union, and at its expiration was appointed United States Marshal of the Territory of Dakota. It is well to know, dear reader, that our material mortal history is but the record of dreams, not of man's real existence, and the dream has no place in the science of being. It is as a tale that is told, and as the shadow when it declineth. The heavenly intent of earth's shadows is to chasten the affections, to rebuke human consciousness, and turn it gladly from a material false sense of life and happiness to spiritual joy and true estimate of being. The awakening from a false sense of life, substance, and mind and matter is as yet imperfect. But for those lucid and enduring lessons of love which tend to this result, I bless God. Mere historic incidents and personal events are frivolous and of no moment unless they illustrate the ethics of truth. To this end, but only to this end, such narrations may be admissible and advisable. But if spiritual conclusions are separated from their premises, the nexus is lost, and the argument, with its rightful conclusions, becomes correspondingly obscure. The human history needs to be revised, and the material record expunged. The gospel narratives bear brief testimony even to the life of our great master. His spiritual noumenon and phenomenon silenced portraiture. Writers less wise than the apostles essayed in the apocryphal New Testament a legendary and traditional history of the early life of Jesus. But St. Paul summarized the character of Jesus as the model of Christianity in these words: "Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." It may be that the mortal life battle still wages and must continue till its involved errors are vanquished by victory-bringing science. But this triumph will come. God is over all. He alone is our origin, aim, and being. The real man is not of the dust, nor is he ever created through the flesh. For his father and mother are the one spirit, and his brethren are all the children of one parent, the eternal good.